You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a UW professor is teaching a history course that has some students asking more questions about their parents' time growing up. We'll hear more about the class that has parents talking about their generation coming up. First, between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on the morning show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we talked to incumbent Secretary of State Doug La Follette. He's a Democrat running for re-election and is being challenged by Republican businessman Jay Schrader. Secretary of State La Follette, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here and talk to all my friends on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, you've been Secretary of State for a few decades now. Give us the short pitch of why Wisconsinites should re-elect you to the office.
Well, the important reason is because I understand the office and what's happened to the office. Over the years, two governors have removed important duties from this office and put them under the governor's control. And that was a big mistake for two reasons. We need to have accountability in government, which means duties should not be all located in one place, namely the governor. But more importantly, the duties that were removed, which involve business activities, corporations, trademarks, uniform commercial codes, for example, are located in Secretary of State's offices all across the country. So since they were removed, it's been a problem for Wisconsin. This office still gets calls and emails every day looking for those duties and those activities. So I think it's important for someone like me who understands this to work with the new governor and legislators to restore those important duties to the office of the Secretary of State.
There has been talk over the years of eliminating the office of the Secretary of State completely. It would take a constitutional amendment to do that. What would you say to that idea?
Well, people have spoken on that idea. They've been trying to do that, and this a year earlier, they finally got a referendum on the state treasurer, and the people rejected that overwhelmingly. The people have basically spoken. They want to elect the public officials. They don't want them to be appointed by the governor or someone.
Can you talk about the remaining duties of the Office of Secretary of State and how you've performed at those?
The current duty that we have, which is important, is called an apostille. It's kind of an esoteric thing. It is an international notary process under the Hague Convention. The Hague being a city in the Netherlands, where many years ago all the countries of the world got together and agreed on the process for international transactions. That could be business, it could be students studying abroad, it could be shipping a dead body back to Europe or somewhere. And people come to this office as many as 50 or 70 a day to obtain these documents, which are called apostilles, so they can be involved in these international transactions.
And talk about how you would go about trying to restore some of the former responsibilities of the Secretary of State to the office under whatever the new set of governor and legislators look like.
Well, I think when the people voted to keep the state treasurer, a number of Republicans said, if we can't get rid of it, let's give it some more important duties like it used to have. And the current state treasurer, the Democrat who's running, her name is Sarah, she wants to restore duties to the state treasurer. And I wish to restore duties to the Secretary of State. So if we're both elected next Tuesday, we're going to work together, I hope, to talk to a new governor. We've got to get a new governor to do this. And legislators, both Republican and Democrat, who agree with the ideas of these important duties being in elected officials.
We're talking to Doug La Follette. He's the incumbent Secretary of State running for re-election as a Democrat in the November elections this year. In a lot of states, the Secretary of State oversees elections in a lot of ways. I think people sometimes come to Wisconsin and are surprised that that isn't what happens here. Is that something you would like to see the Secretary of State play a bigger role in?
I'm glad you asked that question, because my opponents have often said they want to have the election responsibility given to the Secretary of State. It's never been there since I've been Secretary of State for almost 40 years. We have an independent election commission. It used to be retired judges and we should return to that idea. Because here's what happens if you have an elected partisan person as Secretary of State. Look what happened in Florida a few years ago. Look what happened in Ohio. And right now, look what's happening in Georgia and Kansas, where elected Secretary of States are messing around with the election. We don't want that in Wisconsin. We need to keep it as an independent board of hopefully retired judges.
One of the former responsibilities, I think you mentioned this one, of the office was licensing of corporations. Now, is this just sort of a formality? It doesn't matter who does it? Or is there a significant difference if it's done by the Secretary of State versus a cabinet official under the governor's authority?
The significant difference is people finding where to do that. If people wish to do business in Wisconsin, they often come to the Secretary of State because that's where these responsibilities are located all across the country. So if Wisconsin wants to be like the rest of the country, if we really want to be open for business, those duties need to be with the Secretary of State.
As Secretary of State, I think you serve on a couple of boards in the state with some authority there. Can you talk about that part of the job?
Yeah, I serve on only one board. It's called the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, and we manage about 75,000 acres of land, mostly in northern Wisconsin. It's what's left over from the original federal grant when we became a state and the federal government said, okay, this land belongs to Wisconsin. Most of that land was sold for good farmland, etc. But we have a trust fund of over $1 billion, and that money is used to provide loans to schools and municipalities. Most states give the money away, but we kept it. It was a very good idea. And we loan that money, as I said, to schools and municipalities. They pay interest. Then every year we give that interest to the school public libraries. Last year we gave them a check for more than $30 million. And I think it's important to fight to protect that trust fund for the children in Wisconsin.
We have races, high-profile races for governor, U.S. Senate, attorney general, congressional races around the state. The Secretary of State race may not be front and center in people's minds. Can you make the case that people should pay attention to who wins this job?
Well, yes, I think it's important because some of the candidates in the past, and my current opponent, to my knowledge, has ideas that don't make any sense for this office, including having election responsibilities. So I think having someone would have the experience and the responsibility that I have elected this office is quite important, so I can work with the state treasurer and with the new governor to do what needs to be done to make Wisconsin competitive with the rest of the country. Now, this is not about Doug LaFalla. It's about the Secretary of State's office and Wisconsin into the future.
Apart from the actual legal responsibilities of the Secretary of State, do you see an opportunity to use the post as either a bully pulpit or a cheerleading pulpit, some way to use the sort of public authority of that job to make Wisconsin better outside of the direct legal jobs?
Well, yeah, that's a good point and something I've done for years. My background is in science. I'm a scientist and I used to teach environmental science. So I have a great, deep love and appreciation for Wisconsin's environment, our lakes, our streams, our forests. And I have worked for years to help protect them. And in my job as Secretary of State, I've never been afraid to speak out to protect these things. I founded a group. Many years ago, I started a group which is now called Clean Wisconsin. And it's the best environmental group in Wisconsin. They do a great job. And I work with them and other environmental organizations to protect Wisconsin's natural resources.
As we wrap up, do you want to leave listeners with one last message before Election Day?
Well, the message is vote. This is an off year. In non-presidential years like this one, about 500,000 fewer people typically vote, and that's not good for Wisconsin's democratic system. We need to have everyone vote. So vote early, but as a last resort, vote on November 6th. It's very important.
We'll leave it there. Secretary LaFalla, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Democrat Doug LaFalla is the incumbent Secretary of State of Wisconsin and is running for re-election on November 6th. Businessman Jay Schrader, the Republican candidate in that race, will join us this time tomorrow. Between now and the November 6th general election, WPR has invited candidates running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us on Central Time in the Morning Show. You can find all these interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up, a history professor is working to close the generation gap by asking students to find out more about the daily lives of their parents growing up. We'll hear more about the History of Your Parents' Generation course coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the Democratic candidate for State Attorney General, Josh Call. It's the latest in our series of interviews talking to candidates ahead of the midterm elections. First, if you're not a history lover, I am. Some people aren't. A history class can sometimes feel like, I don't know, a chore with a lot of dates and events that feel distant and disconnected to the world of today. But one history professor is taking a unique approach to teaching history to help students connect to the events of the past by interviewing their parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, what memories of music, fashion, and history from your generation do you think young people should know about? And even if you don't have kids, what were the cultural and historical milestones for you in the 70s and 80s? Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is the Merle Curdy and Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor of History at UW-Madison. She teaches a course called The History of Your Parents' Generation. She's in the studio with me. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
We'll talk about the origins of this idea. It sounds like a fun class. What brought you here?
Well, first, Rob, I have to take issue with your description of history as a bunch of boring names and facts and
dates. I love history.
I know. But I don't want our listeners to think that we are boring our students over at UW-Madison. And so in that regard, I would like to think that my exciting, engaging history that brings the past to life is actually very conventional for what my colleagues are doing at UW-Madison. I got to make a shout out for my department and also probably for our satellite campuses as well. So the inspiration for the course, I have to say, came working with students for years here and thinking, you know, what are ways in which I can connect history, you know, whether it's deep, you know, in the past or more recent history, really connect it to my students so they feel the stakes. They recognize that the people who lived in the past are much like them today. I mean, they may have different worldviews and moral commitments, but they were people, you know, shaped by larger forces. And so my original idea for the course was actually to do a history of their generation, so a history of your generation, and it was going to be a more contemporary history. But I, after kind of playing with that idea, I realized how hard it would be for students to toggle between something really autobiographical that might be even personal in a way that might be emotionally hard for them to then widen out and look for larger social factors. So I just did the next thing that seemed logical to me, go a generation earlier. What is the prehistory of their lives? What were the social, political, economic circumstances that shaped who their parents were? And so that the idea was born.
And for a lot of the students you have, say incoming freshmen, their parents would be in kind of my demographic, people born maybe in the 60s and 70s. And is that the zone the sweet spot?
Well, I must say I'm gonna date myself. But I was born in 1970, so there was a kind of I don't want to say unpleasant moment when I realized, oh my dear Lord, that's me, you know, that we're talking about. The demographics is never perfect. Some parents are considerably older, but yes, the course was conceived, and for the most part, it has paired out that the students who are at UW today, their parents would be born in, you know, during the primarily during the 60s and perhaps in the early 70s. And to be honest, there's enough give in the course that even if, you know, someone was born in 55 or even as late as 76, which is conceivable, you know, the course is catching them somewhere in their young childhood, their adolescence, their early adulthood. And so, you know, it may not be exactly the same for every student, but we are definitely providing that student some snapshot, or extended snapshot, I should say, of their parent at some point, and they're growing to become who they became.
And is part of the goal here for students to use this firsthand eyewitness to history, their parent, and hopefully go and talk to somebody, their parent or someone else from their previous generation?
Well, in fact, that's the first assignment that they have. So what they're asked to do is to interview their parents. They can interview one, they can interview the other. You know, in the event that their parents are no longer living or they don't have a relationship with their parent or for whatever reason can't, they're asked to interview someone in their parents' generation. And I provide them a survey asking everything from like your first political memory. What were conversations at the child, you know, at the dinner table? You know, when did you recognize what religion you were, that was something distinct as opposed to what other people happened? What major world event was the first one of your memory? You know, what were your favorite movies, your fashion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they take that information. I mean, that alone is a treasure trove. Many students are, you know, just blown away at how forthcoming their parents are, telling them things they had no idea about their parents. And then they take that first bit of information and they think about generations in history. And then what they do is, so they use some work, some sociological and historical work on what are generations, how can we conceive of generations moving throughout history, and they use it to kind of interpret their own parents through that lens. They put it to the side, and we spend however many weeks, the bulk of the course, doing real high-octane social, political, intellectual history of the period, and then they go back at the end of the course, now, as historians, really understanding this period, and they re-interview their parents in a much more informed way. And I have to say the first surveys are a blast. You know, it's just kind of a mishmash of what the students are learning. The end interviews that are then turned into papers are some of the most powerful things that I have read as a professor, because those students are now informed. They can ask very pointed questions about their parents. And again, it's been really impressive to me how open some of these parents have been about telling their kids sometimes hard things that they otherwise, you know, wouldn't want to share with them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, history professor at UW-Madison, teacher of a course called The History of Your Parents' Generation. I know you can't probably share specific details, but can you give us a sense of the kinds of stories you've gotten back from students and their parents and how they fit into history, maybe in ways that your students didn't expect?
Oh, boy. I want to say each in their own way, every one of these students yields something that... For me also, well, first of all, it can be very moving, you know, because I had a case, I've now taught this class many, many times. I think the first or second time I taught it, a student who hadn't talked to his dad in 10 years.
Wow.
And didn't want to interview him initially because he harbored a lot of upset and resentment. But as the course went on, and again, we're not doing group therapy at all, but just the history gave him some perspective. And I don't even know what it was, but it made him feel that he could forgive whatever it is he needed to forgive. And there was a rapprochement, and he interviewed his dad for that interview and then a paper. One story I like to tell is someone found out that he had a half sibling that his parents told him about.
Okay.
But the parents thought this was maybe an occasion to unveil that. I'll give you an example of one that sticks with me, and that is, and this was several years ago, was teaching a course, and we got to the early 80s and the AIDS, you know, the early AIDS epidemic, you know, Rock Hudson and the first news about AIDS coming out precisely at the moment, you know, when gay liberation is finally, you know, really making its entrance on American stage. And then you have this horrible, you know, epidemic. And one of my students said to me, you know what, while we were reading this material, I think my mom might have actually been a nurse in Boston. I don't know, somewhere. She went back and interviewed her mom. Her mom was at the front lines in Boston at one of the gay clinics that was, you know, right at the nerve center of these killing fields, you know, where so many. And so she was able to find out, you know, she only had this vague recollection that her mom, you know, something about a nurse, maybe something about AIDS, but the class helped crystallize, boom. And she went in and she was able to find out, and the stories her mother had, you know, that she wasn't hiding them from her daughter, but there was no occasion to have that conversation.
I want to ask a kind of a conceptual thing for how students come out of this, because I read a lot of history, and I have trouble there's a distinction. There's now, right? There's the present, and there's history, and that's something different. And trying to grasp the idea that people then were living through now, and people now are living through history.
Yeah.
I'm rambling, like inanely here, but is that something that students are coming out of this class
with? To be honest, you just said it. That's one of the most profound things that they can get out of the course. I mean, there is this sort of binocular vision, if you will, between, they're just moving back and forth between here, now, their parents now as they are, and now, then as they imagined. I mean, and realizing they're part of the history because they're their parents' offspring. You know, they were raised by these people. And so I do think the class has this, I mean, I don't know if binocular vision or stereo sound, there's a dimensionality to the class that I think is very, very, very powerful. I mean, I think one of the things the class tries to do is for them to see their parents in two ways. One, as they became who they were, in part, not exclusively, because of the context in which they lived. The politics mattered, you know, the stagflation mattered, you know, religious contestation mattered. I mean, not in everyone's case in everyone's time, but you know, what you would learn about the 70s and 80s, those movements, those circumstances, those events made their parents who they were. But on the flip side, that their parents were also historical subjects. They were shaping that history. They were acting back on that history. They were the ones wearing the bell bottoms or going to the marches or listening to Bruce Springsteen and changing their major, you know, to be a labor studies historian or, you know, something like that.
Briefly, just in our last few moments, is this for those maybe more a history averse people, is this maybe a gateway drug for those students to say, wow, this is more interesting than I maybe thought it was before I came in?
I love that you use that phrase, gateway drug, because I think about things that are gateway drug to the intellectual life. And I think about books for me that were those gateway drugs. Yay, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, for example. I mean, that's what we all, I think, hope for. And I think this class is pretty good at accomplishing that, making history not feel remote, not feel distant, feel relevant to their life, and maybe get them to want to read more, do more, take another class.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen. She's teaching a course we've been talking about called The History of Your Parents' Generation. Well, with a little thematic music into the news, I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, John Munson and his guest look at the dark store loophole. That's a tricky bit of Wisconsin tax law that means owners of large stores may pay less in property tax than local governments want them to. Find out more and why it matters on Election Day tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the November midterm election is just 8 days away, and we're continuing our series of conversations with candidates all this week. You can hear all of our candidate interviews from Central Time and The Morning Show at wisconsinvote.org. In the race for the state attorney general, today we talked to Josh Call. He's a Democrat running for the seat and a former federal prosecutor. He's on the ballot along with incumbent Republican state attorney general Brad Schimmel and Terry Larson, who's running on the Constitution Party platform. Josh Call, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, why did you want to run for state attorney general? Make your case.
So I am, as you mentioned, a former federal prosecutor. I grew up in Oshkosh and Fond du Lac, and I grew up in a family that was deeply involved in public service. My mom was a prosecutor and elected official. My stepdad, Bill, was a police officer in Nina. My mom's parents were both public school teachers in Fond du Lac. And as a federal prosecutor, I prosecuted drug traffickers, gang members, and murderers. I'm also a dad. I'm a husband, and I want my family and families across Wisconsin to live in a state that's safer and stronger than we're on track for right now. And there's a lot that an effective attorney general can do to help us move in the right direction on a number of issues. But unfortunately, we haven't had effective leadership under our current attorney general. So I want to bring a change of direction to that office.
Well, one of the words you used was safer. What do you see the role of attorney general being when it comes to public safety?
I think our AG should be a leader when it comes to fighting crime and getting justice for Wisconsinites. We have an opioid epidemic that has continued to get worse. We had nearly 900 opioid-related overdose deaths in Wisconsin last year. That's more than a 40% increase just as compared to 2015. The number of kids who've been separated from a drug-addicted parent has increased significantly. And I don't think we're going to beat that epidemic until we start responding to it like the crisis it is. Our current AG also mishandled Wisconsin's backlog of untested rape kits. In his first year in office, we received millions of dollars to test those kits. There were over 4,000 that needed to be tested. But after he'd been AG for 2 years, only 9 of the kits had been tested. And while progress has finally been made, you know, there still have been only 3 people charged and 0 convictions resulting from the testing of kits in that backlog. So getting justice for survivors of sexual assault needs to be a priority as well.
To that, the untested sexual assault kit issue, Brad Schimmel has pointed out this is a problem that grew over 2 decades under Republican and Democratic attorney generals, under police departments around the state. It's not something that was going to be solved quickly. Is that fair to say, you know, 2 years is too long?
So these backlogs built up in jurisdictions around the country, and law enforcement began to recognize the importance of testing these kits. But it was in Schimmel's first year in office when we received millions of dollars to test the kits. And having tested just 9 kits in his first 2 years in office, I think is unacceptable. And if you compare Wisconsin to other jurisdictions that got funding at the same time, you know, after about 2.5 years after we received funding, about 2,000 kits had been tested in Wisconsin. In Portland, they had tested 3 times as many. In Nevada, they had tested twice as many. So other jurisdictions moved faster than we did. And like I said before, there has not been a single conviction resulting from the testing of these kits yet, and only 3 people have been charged with the crime. You know, Brad Schimmel said that the mission has been accomplished, but I fundamentally disagree with that. Testing the kits is part of what we needed to do, but the ultimate goal here is to get justice for survivors.
You mentioned the opioid epidemic, and it's clearly in part a law enforcement problem, but I've heard from people in law enforcement, Republicans and Democrats, this is not a problem you can arrest your way out of or prosecute your way out of. What do you see as part of a all-hands-on-deck effort when it comes to opioid addiction?
I think there are 4 things that we need to do differently or start doing. One is I think we need to ensure that our enforcement efforts are targeting large-scale traffickers who are sending drugs like heroin and fentanyl and meth across county lines and state lines. You know, as a federal prosecutor, I was in the narcotics section, and part of my work was working to dismantle drug trafficking conspiracies. And I think, you know, large-scale investigations that work to dismantle conspiracies is part of what we should be doing. But we also need to significantly expand access to treatment so that people who fall into the trap of addiction are able to get the help that they need to get back on their feet. I also think we need an AG who is finally going to be serious about holding the pharmaceutical companies accountable for their role in this epidemic. And I believe we should expand Medicaid in Wisconsin. If we do that, we'll be able to cover about 80,000 additional Wisconsinites under Badger Care, which means that more people would have the coverage they need to pay for treatment. And we'd also save the state about $190 million a year that we can put to other uses, including expanding access to treatment, prevention efforts, addressing our prosecutor shortage, and reducing health care costs.
Talking to Josh Call, candidate for attorney general running as a Democrat here in Wisconsin. Big issue any attorney general around the country will face is when to join in lawsuits, especially at the federal level. A lot of times it's all the Democrats around the country on one side, Republicans on the other. When is an appropriate time for a state attorney general here in Wisconsin to weigh in on a national issue?
I think there are 2 things we have to look at. Number one, is a federal law or policy harming Wisconsinites? And if the answer to that is yes, then is there a strong legal challenge that can be brought to it? Is the law unconstitutional or otherwise illegal, an illegal administrative action, for example? And if the answer to that is yes as well, then I think the state should get involved. And this is an area where my opponent and I have clear differences in terms of the types of cases that we should be getting involved in. When net neutrality was eliminated, more than 20 AGs were part of a challenge to that. They currently are part of a challenge to that action. I believe that our AG should have joined that. His response was to say that the case was frivolous. When protections for students were defrauded by predatory for-profit colleges were rolled back, a number of AGs spoke out, but our AG didn't get involved. He has gotten the state involved in cases and challenges that I believe are not in the interests of Wisconsinites. So one of the cases he got involved in was a challenge to a rule that guaranteed overtime pay for people who put in the hours and make between about $23,000 and $47,000 a year. So he's fought against overtime pay for middle-class families in Wisconsin. I don't think that that meets the test of, is this policy harming Wisconsinites? I think that policy helped hardworking families in Wisconsin. And as you know, he's one of the leaders right now of a lawsuit that's seeking to invalidate the Affordable Care Act.
Would you try to get Wisconsin off of that lawsuit if elected?
Yes, I would. If that suit is successful, protections are going to be eliminated for people with pre-existing conditions. So health insurance companies would once again be able to deny coverage on the basis of a pre-existing condition. Young adults would lose the guarantee that they can remain on their parents' coverage until they turn 26. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates that more than 30 million Americans will become uninsured if the major components of the Affordable Care Act were repealed. So that suit is clearly not in the interest of Wisconsinites, and I think we should seek to withdraw from it. And as AG, that's what I would do.
Another part of the job is defending state laws from legal challenges. Are there cases where you would look at a state law passed by the legislature, signed by a governor, and say, no, the Attorney General's office should not be defending this particular law?
Generally speaking, I think the AG's office should defend state statutes and state agency actions. The AG is the attorney for the state in litigation. The exception to that is if there is a state statute or a state agency action that's not reasonably legally defensible. And, you know, I can give you an example of one of those actions recently. When Governor Walker declined to call special elections in a state Senate district and a state assembly district, you know, I took a look at that statute, and it was clear that the governor was required to call those elections. I think Brad Schimmel there should have stepped up and said, Governor, this is not a defensible position, and said, you know, I can't defend this. But instead, he did defend the governor, and a judge who was appointed by Governor Walker ruled that those elections had to be called. There, I think Brad Schimmel sided with the governor rather than what the state law required.
As we've seen at the federal level, there's at least one prominent case where the U.S. Attorney General has recused himself from an important investigation that he would otherwise be overseeing, the Mueller probe. Are there issues that you would say, you know what, because of my background with that, I should step aside from this and hand it to a designee below me on the hierarchy?
So I've been involved in challenges to laws that restrict access to voting, including here in Wisconsin, where I was one of the attorneys involved in a challenge to more than a dozen restrictions on voting that were enacted in Scott Walker's first term, as well as a law that limited early voting to one location per municipality, no matter how big the municipality was. And that case is still on appeal. And so because I was involved in that case on one side, I would screen myself off from that case, and the deputy AG would be in charge of that case. So cases where you were involved in one side, the AG shouldn't be involved in the other side of after getting elected AG.
We're talking to Josh Call right now, Democrat running for the state attorney general seat, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? What issue matters to you, and what do you have questions about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Josh Call. He's a former federal prosecutor and the Democratic candidate for state attorney general. He's with us as part of our ongoing election coverage and interviews with candidates. You can find all these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the candidate? What issue matters to you when it comes to the job of attorney general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Mark is on the line in Stevens Point. Mark, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering about the Stephen Avery case and Brendan Dassey. Our current Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, has been pretty vocal in his appeals denials for Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. I was wondering if there would be any change to those policies and locking down some of what Kathleen Zellner has been trying to accomplish with the appeals.
Mark, thanks for the call. That's referring to the Making a Murderer Netflix series, which profiled the two people Mark mentioned in a high-profile homicide case.
So I wouldn't want to comment on the specifics of a criminal case where I haven't read the file and reviewed the case. But generally speaking, the AG's role in appeals of criminal cases is to defend a conviction, if there is a conviction, and defend a sentence, if there is a challenge to the sentence. Again, if there is no legally defensible position, then the AG's role is different. But where there is a legally defensible position, the AG's role is to defend the conviction or the sentence from below or both.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Prosecutorial experience often comes up in these races for attorney general. Attorney generals don't prosecute cases generally. Do we pay too much attention to that one aspect of someone's resume and that part of the job, given all the other responsibilities of the job?
I think a big part of the job is, as I touched on before, fighting crime and working to get justice for Wisconsinites. The AG oversees criminal appeals. The AG oversees the Office of Crime Victim Services, the state crime labs, and the Division of Criminal Investigation. So I think that, having an understanding of how prosecutions work and a background as a prosecutor is important. I'm proud of the work that I did as a federal prosecutor in one of the most dangerous cities in the country. I think our current AG has shown bad judgment on some important public safety issues. Shortly after the tragedy in Parkland, Florida, he suggested that we consider arming teachers in Wisconsin. He's also criticized gun-free school zones. I think that arming teachers would introduce a danger in our schools that isn't there. And as Attorney General, I would fight against any effort to arm teachers. I think what we need are some common sense gun safety measures like universal background checks and a ban on bump stocks and long-term funding for mental health programs in our schools. Our AG also didn't speak out when it came to the topic of the potential distribution of blueprints that can be used to make guns on 3D printers. He said he was studying the issue, and we still haven't heard his position on this. Again, I think our AG should have stepped up there and called for a stop to the distribution of those blueprints, because plastic guns that can be made on 3D printers and that are untraceable are obviously dangerous. And our AG should be a leader on these public safety issues.
There's been a long-running, a little more under-the-radar concern about public defenders in Wisconsin. Public defenders and their supporters say they are underfunded, especially in more remote rural areas. It can be very hard to find an attorney to serve as a public defender in some cases. Is this something you'd want to tackle as Attorney General?
I think the criminal justice system as a whole has not had adequate resources in Wisconsin for a period of time. And I think that we need to address that. And as AG, I'd be an advocate for getting the system the resources that we need. As you mentioned, the pay for public defenders has been too low. But also, we have a significant shortage of prosecutors in Wisconsin. We're over 130 prosecutors short of the number that we should have, according to an analysis by the Legislative Audit Bureau. And it's not good for the system to have cases that get delayed because of a shortage of prosecutors or because it takes more time than it should to find a public defender. And the result of that is that justice is delayed for people. So I think we need to address that. And as Attorney General, I would be an advocate for addressing that.
Talking to Josh Call, Democrat running for Attorney General as part of our series of candidate interviews. You can join in with your questions for the candidate at 800-642-1234. A lot of ways these elections could go in November. One possible scenario, you, a Democrat, end up as Attorney General. Scott Walker could remain as the Republican governor. Republicans control either or both chambers of the legislature. What happens then? Is this a gridlock? Nothing gets done? Or can you cooperate across the aisle?
So I think there are areas in which we could cooperate. And I think it depends on the specific context. So when it comes to enforcing environmental laws or consumer protection laws, there the AG is largely autonomous. The AG can enforce the laws as the AG thinks appropriate. The only real impact that the legislature and the governor have there is obviously they set the laws, but also they can impact funding. But generally speaking, the AG's has discretion about how to enforce those laws. And I think those laws should be fully and seriously and even-handedly enforced. The same thing goes for oversight of the Division of Criminal Investigation. There are other areas, though, where the AG will be working, working with either a state agency or potentially the governor's office. If there's a state law that's challenged or a state agency that's action that's challenged, there the AG is defending the state, and so working cooperatively with you know, the relevant state agency. And then there's a third area, which is a challenge to a federal policy or a federal law. There, the AG needs to get approval from either the governor or one house of the legislature to bring a challenge. And so, you know, quite possibly you'd be working together. So with the elimination of net neutrality, for example, you know, I would be reaching out to the governor. And, you know, if that case had arisen when, you know, if I had been AG when that case arose, I would have reached out to the governor and you know, made the case for why I thought that the policy was harmful to Wisconsinites, because I think the elimination of net neutrality is harmful to consumers. I think it's harmful to small businesses. And I would have made the case for why there's a strong legal challenge to that policy.
A lot of the issues you deal with as Attorney General, they go past one local jurisdiction. How do you see yourself working with a local law enforcement at the municipal or county levels, local prosecutors at the county or district levels to coordinate on issues like that?
I think the AG needs to work closely with local law enforcement, prosecutors, and also with federal law enforcement and federal prosecutors. We talked before a bit about the opioid epidemic, and part of ensuring that our enforcement efforts are targeting large-scale traffickers, I believe, is ensuring that the AG's office is working cooperatively with other law enforcement agencies to work, for example, drug distribution cases up the chain of supply. So, you know, that's the way I think that you can dismantle drug trafficking conspiracies and work to slow the supply of dangerous drugs into that state. So I think working cooperatively is important.
Do you look around at the country and say, hey, this is something we should be doing in Wisconsin and aren't? Are there lessons you would learn from other attorneys general for opioids or any other issue that you think day one you'd be able to kind of steal their ideas?
Well, as I mentioned, I think Wisconsin should have been involved in some of these challenges to federal policies. We haven't been. I also think that, as I mentioned, we need an AG who's going to be serious about finally holding the pharmaceutical companies accountable for their role in this epidemic. 71 out of 72 counties in Wisconsin have now filed suit. Some states have brought suit against pharmaceutical companies for their role in the opioid epidemic. And, you know, the good news is in late 2016 or 17, back then our AG said that he didn't know whether the statute of limitations could be stretched back far enough to hold the pharmaceutical companies accountable. But the good news is that since then he's announced that he's part of a multi-state investigation, which I think is a step in the right direction. But he's also taken campaign contributions from PACs for pharmaceutical companies. So as AG, what I would do is look and see where that multi-state investigation stands, whether it's moving along swiftly, and if not, potentially take a hard look at potentially filing suit.
Got about half a minute or so left. You can leave us with one pitch to voters 8 days out from Election Day.
I think there are clear differences in the AG's race on the issues. I think my opponent far too often has put special interests ahead of the interests of hardworking Wisconsinites, and I think that needs to change. I think we need an AG who we can count on to stand up and work to protect Wisconsin families. You know, my opponent's first deputy AG, the number two person in his office, was a corporate lobbyist who, after serving as deputy AG, went back into lobbying and was one of the lobbyists for Foxconn. And I'm proud to have the endorsement of 61 former assistant AGs, 45 of whom signed a letter saying that the AG's office is a mess.
We'll leave it there. Josh Call, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is a Democrat running for state attorney general. He was here as part of our candidate interviews ahead of the midterm elections. We reached out to incumbent Attorney General Brad Schimmel, who's running for re-election, as well as Terry Larson, who's running on the Constitution Party platform. All candidates were offered interviews. Schimmel and Larson's campaigns did not respond to those invitations. You can learn about all the candidates running in this race and others in the midterm election at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, after this weekend's horrific attack on a synagogue in Pittsburgh, we'll take a look at anti-Semitism and extremist violence in the United States. Also tomorrow, cheap clothing is often disposable clothing and not built to last in your closet or your local resale shop. A Wisconsin designer makes the case for more sustainable clothing. And we'll ask for your childhood food memories and the meals you grew up loving or hating. That and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7:30, it's the 80th anniversary of that famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds radio broadcast about invaders from Mars, based on the H.G. Wells novel. According to legend, listeners panicked, thinking it was a real invasion. Our own Norman Gilliland sorts out myth from reality tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Up next, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll recap the final debate between Scott Walker and Tony Evers and the latest developments in the campaign for governor. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.